The following is a presentation of Second City Works, delivered by your earbuds at WGN Plus.
Welcome to the Second City Works Getting to Yes And. I'm Kelly Leonard, Executive Director of Insights and Improvisation at the world-famous Second City Theater. This podcast is about navigating work and life without a script. Improvisation is a practice in collaborating more effectively, tapping into your full creative potential, and building ensembles who can both support and challenge us. If you like what you hear, please rate us on iTunes and share the podcast through your social media channels. Help us extend the conversation. This is Getting to Yes And.
Working all day for a mean little man with a clip on tight and a rub on tan. He's got me running around the office like a dog around a track. But when I get back home, you're always there to rub my back. Hey, Julie.
My guest today on Getting to Yes And is Marianne McKibben Dana. Marianne is a pastor and the author of The Sabbath in the Suburbs, A Family's Experiment with Holy Time. An avid student and champion of improvisational theater, she loves nudging even stodgy folks to play together and reflect on life as improv. And that has led her to pen her new book, God, Improv, and the Art of Living. Marianne, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be with you.
I love the story that you start with in the book. Many years ago, you worked in Houston's Third Ward, which is an economically depressed area of town, and the local Episcopal Church stood next to a liquor superstore. Tell us what happened.
Yes, there was a wall on the side of the store that was constantly being tagged with graffiti. And so either the liquor store or the church would paint over it, and inevitably it would get repainted with graffiti soon after. And finally, someone at the church realized that they needed to do it differently. And so they contracted with a local artist to take the graffiti that was there and design a mural that would incorporate that design of the graffiti and make a larger kind of design out of it. And so the artist created this design. They got a lot of help creating the image that acknowledged what was there and built on it. Classic improv move. And what was amazing about it is that it provided this great bridge to the young people in the neighborhood who were feeling very disaffected and disconnected. And it was never targeted with graffiti again. I think people really felt acknowledged, and they felt, oh gosh, this is a different kind of community, maybe one we can be a part of. And it, before I knew to call that improv, that was an early experience in my young adulthood of what improvisation could look like in our lives.
Yeah, it's so great because it contains almost every element that we end up talking about in improv, the idea of people being seen, you know, for what's important to them, the idea of seeing all obstacles as gifts, this idea of yes and getting to abundance. It's like, it's all there in this one story. And I just thought it was such a great way to open the book.
Yes.
We were originally scheduled to tape this interview on September 4th. And I usually read the book of the authors that I interview about a week in advance. So I'd started reading your book the week of August 27th. And we haven't talked about this on the podcast yet. It hasn't really seemed appropriate. But on August 29th, I was headed out of town to do a speaking day with my daughter, Nora, who's 16. And I talk about my kids all the time here, called me because she wasn't feeling well. And she hadn't been feeling well for a while, and this was bad. We ended up taking her to the hospital, and she was diagnosed with cancer in her liver and lungs. And you know this because we canceled the appearance and mm-hmm. talked about it a bit. And I was reading the book in the hospital room when it was very early, and you talk about life and death and improv and sickness and elements that were very much wrapped into the story in front of me and, of course, the story of my life writ large, because I work in this field. And I think it might be kind of interesting to sort of talk a bit about improvisation in this caring setting, because I've done work with improvisation for caregivers. We've talked about that in the podcast. But the stakes were always a bit outside, and they weren't so personal. And you have stories in the book of people facing this these kinds of illnesses.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I didn't know the specifics, Kelly, of your situation, and it just hits me right in the heart that you all are facing this right now. And it's such a good example of of why I wrote the book and my kind of orientation in writing the book. I speak to a lot of groups as well, and sometimes there's this initial misunderstanding about, well, you want us to improvise, you want us to do comedy, and it's so beyond where I really saw improv take hold, which, as you mentioned, I tell a story in the book, and several stories actually, but one in particular about a family that was experiencing a health crisis. And to me, it was nothing but improvisation.
Right.
I mean, this thing happened to them that was nowhere on their radar. They never could have predicted it, and it threw everything into a tailspin. And what I observed in seeing their journey through that, and also the way that the medical personnel was with them, it was always about what happened with the patient yesterday, how do we need to adjust, what is the best outcome that we can work for today. And that, to me, is the spirit of yes and.
Mm-hmm.
And the simple fact that there's so much that happens in our lives that we never would have chosen. It's not like yes and is always this chipper choice that we make.
Right.
Sometimes it's all that we have. I mean, it's our only choice is to say, well, I can't change this. And so how can I live in such a way that brings about the best, the most positive outcome for everyone involved? And so I'm so sad to hear you all are going through this, but it is also very gratifying to talk to someone who really internalizes that message on a really deep level.
Yeah, well, look, nothing that's worth it in life doesn't hurt.
Right.
That's been my experience. Oh my God. I mean, just everyone think back to teenage year. I mean, the worst in terms of that,
right.
But because it was worth it, and marriages are hard and politics are hard and our jobs are hard.
Right.
And that only means that it's working. And the thing that I've noticed, the biggest takeaway I've got for the last, 60, 70 days that I've been going through this is there are so many errors and mistakes that I've seen are these incredible caretakers at the hospital make, and that Anne and I have made. Like, I gave her like the wrong medicine at the wrong time over the weekend, and I was like, oh my God. And then my wife, also a far superior improv pedagogical expert than I am, but turned to me and was like, it's fine, leave it. We're okay. It's good. And it was okay. There was no problem. And we've been at the hospital and they've said, go to floor 4. And I'm like, I think you said floor 5 before. And this is not a minor thing because you get lost and then you've, lost time
right.
and other things. So, there's lots of that goes on. And if your mindset is one of which would be very natural, frustration, anger, any of that, you make no progress. But when you have a mindset of, again, see all obstacles as gifts. The gift I've got is in calling those mistakes out with no shame or no retribution, no anger, no fear. You actually, this ensemble that you have the attempt build, people feed off of it. That
exactly.
level of, the honesty. When you are just really honest and you're like, no, I get it. It's cool. You get that back.
What
I think we need to build ensembles in these situations, because otherwise it's just on our shoulders, and it's not. The fact is, it's not.
Right. Yes, absolutely. And it reminds me of that story, which I'm sure you've heard too, of Herbie Hancock improvising with Miles Davis.
Yeah.
And Herbie plays the wrong chord, and he says, and Miles just pauses and plays some notes that makes the chord right.
Yeah.
And what Herbie Hancock says is he didn't hear it as a mistake. He heard it as something that happened. It was an event.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not to say that everything in our lives is a welcome thing, but I have used that so many times in my life when something happens that just totally throws me for a loop. I think, okay, that is a thing that happened. It's and so now what? And it's such an act of grace. I write about this from kind of the spiritual perspective of not just improv is not just a valid and helpful way of being in the world, but it really just gets at the heart of what it means to be a human being, which is that we are vulnerable. Mm-hmm. Things happen to us and around us, and we are not in control. But what we are in control of is the next move and how we receive that offer that has been given to us.
Yeah, let's talk about us as human beings. So one of the things that we've learned from our work with behavioral scientists is that in behavioral economics, we know that people's default behavior is to do nothing or to say no. And you write in the book, quote, "We live in a world saturated by no." And this is because that's the way human beings appear to be oriented. And I don't know if it's out of fear or what, but that seems to be the case.
Yes, it does seem like part of the wiring, right? Mm-hmm. To be fundamentally resistant to change. And one of my favorite authors, Flannery O'Connor, says all of human humans resist grace because grace changes us and change is painful. Hmm. I mean, it is painful to move into a new place, into a higher sense of our own consciousness or our own, evolution in terms of how we are in the world. And it's much easier to do what's familiar and what's comfortable. And I think probably from an evolutionary perspective, that was very helpful. We needed to, stay with our tribe and do what we know works. And we live in a world now where our survival depends on the ability to change and embrace the unexpected. We are living in a time where the planet's climate is changing at a very rapid rate, and we frankly don't have time to hem and haw about, I'm not sure how we navigate this change. We need to start, reacting in a kind of spirit of yes and to say we've got to jump in here and see what we can do.
And the yes and is hard, right? So we talked about that before. And you also, another great author, Anne Lamott, you quote her as saying, quote, "Everything I've let go has claw marks on it." Yes and ain't easy. And it involves surrendering the need to be right. It involves actually tossing yourself into the exact area you probably don't want to be.
Exactly.
And I'm curious.
Exactly.
Yeah, for you, when you first got exposed to this principle, when did that aha moment come on that, yes and, oh my God, that is that is the spirit of life and movement and change?
I had a wonderful instructor when I took my first improv class at Second City. I've taken classes here. I live in Washington, D.C., and so mm-hmm. I've taken classes from Washington Improv Theater and also been able to travel up to Chicago in the summer and take some of the adult intensives. And the first improv class I took there, amazing instructor. We would do these exercises and then we would sit and reflect on them. And it was like the best of therapy to me we were getting at really the heart of, for me, my resistance comes in the form of perfectionism, of needing to have a good, sound idea, fully formed, vetted, and that's my own control stuff. And I remembered her saying again and again, the only thing I don't want to see from you is hesitation.
Yep.
I want to see you put yourself out there. And even if you put yourself out there and it's a word association game and the word you say is,
use it.
That is a contribution, and it's a moment of delight because people were like, can be like, yeah, I've been there. mind freezes up too.
You can name check the instructor.
Liz Joint Sandberg.
Yeah. So Liz is great.
And yeah. She's a fantastic, I continue to keep in touch with her, and she was so gracious when I was writing the book. She read some early drafts and just was such a great conversation partner in that and continues to be. I remember that week I posted on social media, or maybe I wrote to some friends. I said, Liz Joint Sandberg is a midwife for courage and an exorcist of shame, because both of those things happened in that class. And it is what is so enlivening about improv is that it helps. At least it has helped me, and I've seen it in other groups that I have either led or been a part of, that people find themselves transformed when they let go and just put themselves out there in a very vulnerable and real way and realize there are people around them who can be trusted to receive that vulnerability. Mm-hmm. And that shame, as you say, has no place in that, because we are all human. We are all doing the best we can. And certainly there are places that where that is not affirmed. And that is, you know, always hard to deal with when you have that impulse and you want to be real and you're not sure it's a safe place to do that. But most people, I think, really respond in a generous way when they see somebody being real and really vulnerable.
So Liz, of course, has a background as a young person in the evangelical movement. And so let's go there. You write in the book, quote, improvisation is at the very center of how God interacts with us, because at the heart of the story of the Christian God is a story of yes. So let's dig into this. Let's unpack this very the improv, God, the Bible. What are you seeing as you put these pieces together?
Yeah. Well, part of why I wrote the book and part of why I was drawn to improv is it was a way for me to think about my own spiritual journey in a way that made sense given the real suffering in the world. And there is certainly a theology and a spirituality out there which says everything happens for a reason. God has a plan. It's all kind of according to this grand vision. And there are people who are very comforted by that. And it is something that you find in more evangelical circles that, you know, who are we to question the plan? We need to figure out what God's will is and follow that. And I ultimately don't find that version of deity very satisfying or enlivening for my life. It just requires me to believe in a God that would visit any manner of suffering on people for some higher purpose. Right. And I think we just live in an imperfect world. And to me, where I see all of this coming into play is that, I see this grand improvisation happening in which things happen in our lives and perhaps however we understand a higher power or even just community or humanity, our call is always to find the best yes possible. And that to me that's something I can use, you know, it ultimately doesn't provide an answer as to why, but improv doesn't really need a why. It just deals with what is. Here's what's right in front of us. Now, what do we do with it? And that to me is much more practical than trying to figure out the higher, you know, trying to solve the puzzle. That ultimately to me isn't very satisfying.
One of the things I've been reflecting on in thinking about this, and it's come more in collaborations we've done in the ethics space. And of course, you cite Sam Wells, and we've talked to Sam Wells in the podcast, who is a really smart guy who's talked about Christian ethics and improvisation. But what I've seen in the improv space is there are these rules, so to speak, say yes and put your focus on others, that end up becoming things you forget as they should be second nature, so as you can kind of exist in the space freely. But you always have them to rely back on. And then the other thing that happens in the improv theater space is there's all these rites and you know, the thing we do before any performance where we all clap each other on the back and say, I've got your back. And the very specific stuff. And if you think about a theatrical experience where you have music playing as people enter you, and it's like, oh, churches did that, you know, like church is a performance and we're doing a performance. Right. And of course that appears to be related, right?
Yes, right. And I years ago, I went to a workshop that was teaching how to learn biblical stories, learn them by heart. They don't use the word memorization, but that's essentially what we were learning. And the instructor said, you know, people dismiss this as performance, it's too showy. It's not really. But he said, you know, if you look at the word perform, it literally means to form to completion or to form fully. And And I think about the kind of performance that, good improv is. And yes, it's frequently hilarious and very, very clever. But what it does even more deeply is a fully formed, fully immersive experience for the players and for the audience. And we're all in it together. And that to me is really what this life of improv is about. We're trying to form our lives fully and fully inhabiting them, not just people who execute a plan, you know, figure out what we want to do when we retire and just grind at it day after day, year after year, but receive the world as it imperfectly is and as it beautifully is and as it terribly is sometimes. And it keeps us grounded in the moment too, I think, which is really important and helpful for me as I, you know, if I'm dealing with something that just feels overwhelming to me, it's very freeing to say, I don't need to know how this is going to play out in 3 months. I just can't know. So all I need to do is get through today. And how can I do that in the way that brings about the most wholeness for myself and for my family and for my community? And that to me is very clarifying to have that kind of focus.
You were talking earlier about how people sort of mix improvisation and comedy. And I've had this happens all the time to me because I'm on the speaker circuit, right? And they know I'm going to come talk. Mm-hmm. And I have this entire conversation with them about improvisation and what I'm going to talk about. And later I'll get an email back where like, okay, you're talking comedy. And I'm like, wait, no.
Cause, right.
But I think one of the reasons that happens is both comedy and improvisation traffic in truth, and surprising truth tends to be what comedy is a lot of the time. And
yes,
as we live in this world of so-called fake news and fake information, all that, and even Colbert going back to truthiness, that is a very rich, interesting area that we're playing in, not, I think, consciously, because you can't when you're improvising. But indeed, the kind of discovery process, the thing that makes us laugh usually is when something really exquisitely human, which means it's probably a little bit wrong or discovering something that's wrong, is what elicits the laugh. But the laugh is really coming from the, that is so surprising to me because it's true of something in this moment.
Yes, right. Yeah, I was just listening to something, and I can't remember, so I can't quote who it was, but probably a podcast talking about humor that is so specific that it becomes universal.
Yeah,
you know, the sort of universality in the particular. And I think about the guidance that you get in improv classes and also with groups to make a specific offer instead of, you know, our impulse is to sort of be very general because we want to give our scene partner a lot to work with, but actually it's much better guidance to give them something specific to work with that they can. And that also is where the humor often comes, is in that real specificity that feels both unexpected, but also universal. And it is a paradox to think about that kind of, I just watched Hasan Minhaj's, I think it's called Homecoming King, his comedy special. And he is speaking from the perspective of an Indian immigrant male, you know, lots of experiences I do not have. And there was a lot that I thought I'm probably missing a cultural reference here. And yet it still was so relatable in so many ways. And that's the beauty, whether you're funny or not on stage. And often, as you say, the improv humor is grounded in truth, and that kind of universal human experience. But I think it is an interesting, it's just a mystery how that paradox works of universal and particular together.
Yeah. We're constantly, when I think about failures in the comedy process during when we're creating a sketch review, or failures in the business process where something hasn't gone because we marketed it poorly, it's always a lack of specifics. We're always like, why did we go and try to build this giant thing when really all we needed to say was, this is about you getting difficult conversations, making it more effective, or, you know, name it, the sort of naming it thing. And one of the things I wanted to talk to you about, you quote an artist, Keith Snyder, in the book, who said, quote, "May I break in interesting ways." All right. So I was like, yeah. And the reason I responded to that is I actually did my college thesis on the Beat Generation. And the term Beat Generation wasn't actually coined by Kerouac. It was coined by a guy named John Cullen Holmes. And it was less about jazz beats, which I think people think about. It's more about the tension between being beaten down and being beatific. That was the conversation that Kerouac and Holmes were having. Yeah. And actually, I had a long conversation with this about Del Close, the late great guru of improvisation.
Yes.
But that seems to also tie into what we're talking about here. And as people might not know, Kerouac, his spontaneous beat prosody is what he called his writing, which was improvisational writing. He just kind of went with it without editing, and later the editors figured it out. So,
yes.
So Kierkegaard talks about this too. It's the sort of existential leap of faith, you know, when you're in a sort of a void space. But talk to us a little bit about how improvisation plays at that edge, because that's kind of a dark place to be.
I love that. Well, and Keith is also a good friend of mine, and he was referencing, I think, a Brian Eno quote where he says, analog synthesizers break in interesting ways, and digital synthesizers just break. Like, they don't work. You know, once they spritz out, they're not working. But analog will do these kind of interesting, weird sounds. And I've been so struck by that. And what the first thing that came to mind when you were talking about that is I'm in the process of doing National Novel Writing Month, mm-hmm. NaNoWriMo, which is November. For a lot of people, they set a goal to write 50,000 words. And I'm actually writing nonfiction, so I'm kind of breaking the rules a little bit, not writing a novel. But one of the suggestions that I read, and I've been doing this each day as I write, is to write, I write on the computer, but to write it in white font. So you can't actually see the words as they are appearing. I mean, if you're just at that, I'm at that stage right now where I'm just trying to get ideas down, right? Yeah. I'm not editing. And it has been such a fascinating experience to just be typing and having ideas come out of my head and I can't see them. I trust that every now and then I'll highlight and go, okay, it's there. I'll look at it later. But the point is to just, to show up to the process. And to trust what's going to come out, which is going to be, I mean, you know, maybe it's kind of beat in that way because I can't see it, I can't judge it, and that gives me permission to say some things on the screen that maybe I wouldn't if I could see those words in black and white, and I would go, ooh, that's scary, that's a little too close to home. So I think that's a piece of this too, is what I love about improv. There's no artifact when you're done. You know, I mean, you can do a video of it, I suppose. Although a lot of my teachers have said, it kind of kills it when you try to do a video, because it just, you can't capture that immediacy. But I love that about it. It is a process, and you show up to it, and it's either brilliant or terrible or somewhere in between, or maybe all of the above. And yet it's really about how it forms you and the audience and your fellow players.
I'm not a historian by any stretch. I just read a lot. But it does, you know, of course, Spolin was developing the improv exercises that are the basis of our work at Second City in the 20s and 30s. And it really sort of started to become, you know, its thing in the late 50s. And if you think about the art movements of those periods, we were moving. So you look at comedy, right? We were moving out of mother-in-law jokes to Lenny Bruce, which was dangerous and not always funny. And then you look at the development of Andy Warhol and Jackson Pollock in the art world and novels that were starting to sort of play with the form. And I wonder if what's interesting about improvisation, certainly you can see how it fits with the other art forms, but more so in the pedagogical aspects of it, it is almost like it's ambiguity practice. Giving us and our muscles the ability to weather ambiguity. If I look at the world today and I'm like, what is going on? It feels like we're still in that fight between the world that made sense to people who thought it should be right or wrong, black or white, and the more sort of relativistic way that thinking has moved in academia and art and, you know, which seems to fight that narrative.
Right. Yeah, it reminds me of, I don't know if you've had a chance to talk about to Patricia Madsen in her book Improv Wisdom, which is kind of a classic now, but
yeah.
She talks about the three ways of looking at a situation. You can look at it and see what's wrong with it, which is the critical method, and you can try to see the situation objectively, which she calls the scientific method. She says that really isn't possible because we're always in the mix, which I think speaks to what you're saying in this kind of postmodern or whatever is following postmodern. Maybe we're post-postmodern. But this lack of black and white. And then, of course, the third, you know, preferred method, the you know, life-giving method is the improviser's method, which is to see the gift in it. I think that does lend itself. It does suggest a certain ambiguity that we are left with. I quote Dan Pink in the book, whom I think you talked to recently on the podcast, and I love his quote where he says, you know, he's talking about the importance of just doing and creating and taking risks. And he said, it is risky to live that way, to live that life of just putting yourself out there and taking creative risks. But he says the greater risk is to choose false certainty over genuine ambiguity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really when I speak to groups about this stuff, that's really the aha that people, I think, that really resonates at a deep level is this certainty and this need to have it figured out and to know, you know, what is the plan and what's the purpose and all of this is really comforting on one level. But I think many of us who really live there long enough start to realize that it's kind of a sham, that there's what we really want in on a deeper level is a genuine ambiguity to say, I don't have the answers, but I have really life-giving questions and those are going to serve me better than a little pat answer that I just sort of brush my hands off and have it all figured out. And that to me is not the way the world works. And it's certainly not what improv has taught me to embrace.
Yeah. We're so afraid of that. And we're afraid of not having the answer. And not having the answer is our, it's our condition.
Right.
So, how do we powerfully lean into that? I'll often say when I'm trying to like break this down, I've been talking to our nurses a lot about this stuff, cause I've been in the hospital so much. And I say, you know, in essence, improvisation is human being practice. And that's, they seem to like really respond to that. They're like, oh, I like, yes, I don't have a script. You're right. I can see how that could be helpful.
That's right.
You have this quote, and I think it comes at the end of the book, and I want to read it because it's like it really moved me, and it's stuck with me, which is, quote, we don't say yes because it will move the cause of justice and peace forward, though we hope it does. We don't improvise because it's the most effective way to live, though it might be. We do it because that's all there is. There is no other option. The alternative is passive oblivion. Wow. Let's talk about what you mean by passive oblivion, because it's a very powerful two words put together.
Right. It's interesting. We're recording this on Election Day, a lot of people are going to the polls, and some people are in places where their vote really can make a difference. Things are very close, and other people are finding it hard to figure out the motivation to get to the polls because they're either are in a very red district or a very blue district, and they may agree or disagree, but what difference does it make? And I was telling someone today, we cast that vote because it's important to, it may feel like a shout into the void, but we still have to shout. It's our last and most precious freedom is to say and to choose how we will respond to a situation and to make a decision not to respond. That's what I mean when I say passive oblivion. It's just to give up your own agency in that. And I don't know, we live in really hard times where I think a lot of people, there's so much going on in the world and we know about all of it and it feels so overwhelming. And I can't remember whether I quote Lord of the Rings in the book in this context, but there's this scene in which, you know, in the Two Towers when the people at Helm's Deep are it looks like all is lost, but they know they have to take this final stand. And King Théoden says, If this is to be our end, I would have them make such an end as to be worthy of remembrance. And I think about, that's what I think I was getting at with that sense of, we may, yes and may not, you know, further these causes we believe in, but they're still, we do it because it is a good in and of itself. It is worth saying yes and, even if our efforts ultimately are not fruitful in the way we would like them to be. It is still a good in and of itself to make that stand and to seek out that yes and.
Yeah, thinking about this in the political context, I think I've mentioned this in the podcast before, but if I haven't, I was doing a keynote at the L.A. Book Festival, and there was a woman with a Make America Great Again hat in the audience who was nodding enthusiastically with everything I was saying. And I was like, oh, she's agreeing with me. But you know why she was agreeing with me? Because my truth, when I'm speaking my truth, it doesn't negate her truth. And even if she's taking it in a whole other direction. And politically, I think that is a very difficult place for us to be right now, is recognizing that you can resist in love because we have to.
And I,
everyone knows my politics. It's not hard to figure it out. But I have a real hard time with this because I can't live in a place where we're writing off, you know, half the planet because they're operating out of fear, perhaps, or I think they're misinformed. And the opposite. Yes. They can't do that to me. And it's like that is the way of madness, which I think is also what you're getting to there, which is this this need to act and scream if you must. But at the same time, you know, you got to love as well and love those who are different and disagree with you.
Right. Yeah. And improv, I mean, what I love about it and where I ultimately saw connections with my own religious tradition, which is Christianity, is that it is so servant based. It is a, you know, the first time I ever improvised on stage, I was brand new and I was improvising with people who'd been doing it for decades. And I was petrified because I thought they are not going to have fun with me up there. I'm going to be like deer in the headlights and this is going to be just really a hard night for all of us. And my friend who kind of had connected and made this group happen said, no. Their job is to make sure you not only do well, but have fun. I mean, their job is to take care of you. That is their job. And it was such a comfort. And I also was able to take care of them in some ways, to the extent that I was able to as a brand new kind of improviser. And so it's that servant orientation that I think the world so desperately needs, and what I think there's so much potential in the set of tools for us right now. What does become difficult, I recently was with a group of pastors, and we were talking about these things, and one of them said, you know, the difficulty is when you're, you know, improvising with someone, when you're, quote, on stage with someone, what if you don't have the same reality? Different, you know, and it's this kind of, we're listening to and watching and reading totally different sources of information. And so it makes it very difficult to have a sort of an understanding with one another. Here are the basic set of facts.
Right.
You've come at these solutions differently than I do, but we can work with that. And that's really the challenge right now. And frankly, I don't have a good answer to that. But I think it's something that we need to think about as a culture.
You know, I reflect on that because I've told the story before, but I remember one of the most memorable auditions we ever held at Second City involved Adam McKay, who has gone on to, of course, do all those crazily funny movies with Will Ferrell. He was the head writer at Saturday Night Live and directed and wrote The Big Short. Adam was clearly the best improviser in this group that got called back at Second City. And there was also a gentleman in the group who was clearly... I don't know the scientific or technical term, but he was acting very weird, aggressively so. And normally what we do when you have someone who could potentially derail everything for their partner, and this is like a major audition, is we put them with the best person, because our feeling is like, well, they could probably make something out of this. And if they can't, we know we like this person anyway, so we're okay. So we put this person with Adam, and Adam yes anded, like, this person kept advancing even more insane scenarios, and Adam would be like, okay, I know this seems like I shouldn't say yes to you. I am actually going to say it. He was just like calling it out on stage in such a wonderful way that we're laughing so hard, we're crying. The only thing I think that was very confusing for this guy who improvised with him is when he didn't get called back, he's like, we did the best scene I've ever seen in my life. I'm like, and you had nothing to do with it.
Right.
You know, it was unrelenting in its surprised support, and almost sort of honestly surprised support, like, by all means, what you're saying, I shouldn't be saying yes to and I'm going to. Now, I think that is a very short-term kind of solution, but there is something inside of there that, you know, we've done work with improv and people who have dementia. There is, you're not going to get them to, you know, somehow snap back into your reality. And by the way, who's to say your reality is all that real? Try on their reality. Try it on for a bit.
Yes.
What's the day? And again, well, yeah, so I'm curious that you respond.
Yes. Yeah, there you go. I think there's something to that, because to me, what I'm hearing and what you're saying is this is a practice of empathy.
Mm-hmm.
And the task of seeing the world through that other person's eyes, it is very disarming. It is it's deeply powerful when we're able to see and be seen. That lowers the defenses, and so maybe that's part of what we need to be doing as well. Is just, and one thing I try to discipline myself with when I'm not very good at it, but it's my hope and goal when somebody says something I disagree with is to ask a question first,
right,
rather than go straight into, well, here's what I think, or here's why you're wrong.
Right.
Is to at least for one question, one comment on Facebook or one, you know, comment on Twitter, just to ask, well, what do you mean by that? Or is this what you're saying? And that's just my little, I try.
Yeah.
I'm not always perfect at it, but maybe that's part of that yes and impulse to.
Yeah, and you might not have seen this yet in any of our stuff, but, you know, our second science project, the University of Chicago, which deals with behavioral science and improvisation, the answer that we got to the sort of like, how do you yes and when you have that actual disagreement is this idea around thank you because. You say thank you to someone expressing gratitude, and the because is where you need to rephrase in their words what they said to you so you fully understand it. And in that sense, someone feels heard and seen. And if you ask of them to do that with you, you have a fighting chance of staying inside this conversation.
Powerful.
Yeah.
Powerful.
Yeah. All right. So we always end the podcast. This is like the biggest layup I've ever handed anyone on the podcast to tell me a yes and
yes
story. So I'm going to give you freedom to either tell us a yes and story or anything else that you really want to touch on as we wrap up our conversation.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a bit of a yes and, but it's something that happened recently that I think speaks to just the power and the delight in having. For me, improvisation is an orientation towards grace and towards what's possible. So I was meeting with a group of clergy a couple of weeks ago. We were going to have breakfast together. It was a Monday morning. And we got there, and my host, who was planning this and made all the arrangements, or not, as it turned out, because I walked in and she said, I can't believe I never did get the confirmation number from the bakery that was going to bring the pastries. And I realized, I think I must have, and we've all done this, right? We've had multiple tabs open on our browser, and we've done several things at once, and she never finished that task, right? And realized it that morning. And I was like, all right. Well, and she said, well, we're talking about improv. I expect I'll be, you know, this will be a story someday. I said, of course, right? Because that's part of it too, is you use the world around you as inspiration. But, you know, people came and she sort of explained. And what I thought was going to happen is it was going to turn into a yes and this did happen, of people sharing, oh, you know, I was late for a funeral a couple weeks ago, or, you know, stories shared about, you know, other kinds of, which turned out to be such a wonderful, that was a feast in a different way,
right?
And so that yes and of people being willing to accept her vulnerability and her imperfection and yes and it with their own. But then what happened is somebody must have gone out to their car and they must have had a little grocery store thing of like cupcakes with the garish colored icing on top, you know, and they brought that in and said, hey, here's something. And somehow it really was kind of a stone soup, if you know that children's story, where people kind of provide little ingredients and somehow they make soup together. These things started to appear on the table, and it was a fantastic feast. And I don't know where it all came from, but it was people provided out of their own sense of wanting to provide what was needed for that event in the wake of something not going as planned. And it was so lovely, and I think much, much more delicious than it would have been with our nicely pre-planned snacks. And it was just a true delight. And to me, it is the spirit of Yes And, because it was everyone working together and making something out of nothing.
I love that, obviously.
They just found a way.
Yeah.
That you just made me think of this moment in Second City history when 9/11 happened. We were like 2 days away from opening a new show. So that show was instantly irrelevant. Fine, whatever, we figured it out. But what do we do that night? And we were going to close, and we never closed at Second City, but it didn't make any sense to stay open. But Kevin Dorff, who was in the cast, who wrote for Conan O'Brien forever, big, big alternative comedy guy, and really, I would say, one of the contemporary masters of the work, just a brilliant improviser. Kevin literally was like, not on my watch. And I'm like, okay, what do you want to do? Because there was other cast members like, I'm not performing. So he and Jack McBrayer, who I think was in the ETC cast at the time, a couple of the box office guys said, we're going to put on an improv show. Just let anyone know it's free if they want to come. And so we let all the customers know we're going to refund your tickets, but if you actually do want to come, free of charge, there'll be a group here doing an improv show. And about 80 people showed up. And most of them were tourists who were sort of trapped in their hotel. Most of them didn't have reservations, just didn't know what to do, and kind of on a lark called and were like, okay, I'll go to Second City. And they found an open pizza place, so the guys did the improv show, and then cast and audience all had pizza, and then we gave them free beer. And
beautiful.
Yeah, and it was this tragedy moment where everyone found a place to come together around performance and food and drink, and just sort of shared being in the same space together. And it kind of didn't matter who they were or why. And I think we need more those stories shouldn't be the exception, and I think they need to be the rule.
Absolutely. Yeah. I'm remembering that day, too. I was in graduate school doing my ministry training, and we continued classes that day. And professors said, if you need to go home, you know, but we're going to continue to be about the work that we do here, which is training people to be leaders of spiritual communities in a really, really chaotic world. And one of our professors quoted, I don't think it's a real quote, but it's one of those apocryphal quotes from Martin Luther that said, when the world is falling apart, we plant a tree. And that's what you all did that night. And that's what we did in continuing the work that we were doing. And that's what the world needs. And improv is a lovely set of tools for that work.
The book is called God, Improv, and the Art of Living. I highly recommend it. Marianne McKibben-Dana, thank you for coming on the show.
It has been a delight and a joy. Thank you, Kelly.